The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing and track days and just all sorts of different stuff, whatever we can think of. Today is January 11th, 2008. This is episode number 110, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you the latest in whatever stuff I can come up with. Yeah, so first of all, before we launch into anything else, I do want to send a big thank you out to Alan McPhail. Alan was kind enough to send a donation to MotoGPOD. He went to the website, clicked on the link on the left side, says donate to MotoGPOD, and he sent me a donation to help pay for the podcasting bills like Skype and hosting and bandwidth and all those kind of things that are associated with doing a podcast. So thanks a lot, Alan. Do appreciate that. And other stuff that we've got going on today. First of all, I've got a few topics that I want to cover, kind of a bouncing around, and I'm just going to do that all in a big long stream of consciousness thing here in the intro. A variety of different things, a little bit of MotoGP news, some emails that I got, some other comments, and all sorts of stuff. After that, we're going to have a call with Doug Hagee of Shadow Video Productions. He runs a track day videography company back east, and going to talk a little bit about his operation out there. It's kind of interesting stuff. I think you're really going to enjoy that. And then we're going to follow that up with a blast from the past, a rerun of a tech segment that I did in episode number 38, which was almost exactly 2 years ago today, about suspensions. A little bit of the history of some of the different kinds of motorcycle suspensions that you found, and we're going to have that. So we've got kind of a lot of stuff to cover here. Welcome back after our hiatus. It's been 2 weeks since I talked to you last. First of all, I'm going to launch into a little bit of a rant. I try not to politicize, well, anything. I try to keep politics and all those kind of touchy subjects out of the show because it's you know, it's not a show about that sort of stuff. But some of it might happen to creep into this item. Bad news was that the Dakar Rally was canceled this year, completely canceled, all of it. Not just a stage or two, but the entire thing. This happened on Thursday the 3rd, which was just before the rally was due to kick off on the weekend there, on the Saturday the 5th. And it was very, very disappointing. There was threats from Al-Qaeda elements in Mauritania, apparently very specific threats, because there had been earlier threats or intelligence of some kind of sort, and they felt that, you know, they were going to be able to continue and do on to the rally in any case and everything. But then some very specific threats came out, and they decided to cancel the entire rally, the organizers did. And this is such a shame because we're basically giving in to what the terrorists want. They're giving them press, which is the main thing that they want. They want to call attention to their cause, which in the case of Al-Qaeda, I think that few people with a lick of sense have a whole lot of sympathy for their cause. I mean, even this is not any kind of knock against religion of any kind or anything like that, but these people are just they're nuts, to be honest with you. And on the other thing, I think that it takes a lot of money away from some countries that can desperately use it. Mauritania, Senegal, these countries there, you know, they get a lot of money from the Dakar Rally coming in there. It's a big boost to their economies, and they're not going to get that this year. And I hope that the sensible citizens of those countries down there in Africa that desperately need this influx of income, I can hope that they realize that Al-Qaeda has done this to them, and that perhaps they will that it'll be a lessening of support in those areas for these terrorists, pure and simple dirt bag, scumbag, nasty, evil terrorists who understand one thing and one thing only, and that's violence. And it's a sad state of affairs. And I could think of a few different suggestions of how they could have ran the Dakar Rally, one of which is providing helicopter gunship support. So you just have some helos flying over wherever the races are, orbiting around, waiting for some sign of activity, and then they come in and mow them down with the Gatling guns. Or possibly what I did when I was in Iraq is convoy security. We drove Humvees. They've had Hummers in the Dakar Rally. The rally would have been a lot slower. It probably would have taken more along the lines of at least 2 months instead of 2 weeks to get from Lisbon down to Senegal. But, you know, you would have got there if you had a few armored Humvees with machine guns and Mark 19s and all that sort of good stuff mounted on top, escorting the racers in little groups as they slowly went through there. It, you know, probably wouldn't have been very exciting to watch, but it would have been effective. And so I'm saddened by that, and I make light of it and all that, but really, what can you do? I mean, there's not much else you can do besides just sort of give up and move on. And I am sad to say that I think it's probably the last running of the Dakar Rally, that they didn't even quite make it to 30 years, 29 years, and I really doubt that in 2009 it'll be back again, because the terrorist assholes, to coin a phrase, will do the same thing again. And due to fear of harm to the racers or any of the fans or the support staff of the rally and all of that, which we don't want to see. We don't want anybody get hurt or kidnapped or worse or whatever. Due to fear of that they're going to have to cancel it. And I really, I hope that 2009 is a different story, but I predict that it won't be. All right, moving on to slightly more cheerful, or how about less cheerless news. One of the things that popped up on the MotoGP radar this past couple of weeks is some comments that Rossi made about Toesland, James Toesland. And Valentino Rossi believes that James Toesland has made a mistake in joining Tech 3 Yamaha for his rookie season in MotoGP, and that he should instead have signed with a Honda team. Rossi says that maybe Toesland has made a small mistake. He told Motorcycle News, I imagine that for him, it would be better to race with Honda. Now, one point that David Emmett made from Kropotkin Thinks, the blog that you'll find at MotoGPMatters.com, and David made the point that anything that Rossi says has to be sort of analyzed and taken with a grain of salt, almost to a point that perhaps this is just one more way for Rossi to kind of take a dig, light a fire, whatever you want to call it, at Yamaha to give him a bike that's more competitive to do the things that he wants, in effect, by pointing out, that he thinks that Toesland's not going to be as successful on the Yamaha as on the Honda, that sort of a thing. And I think I agree with that. I do agree with that. I don't think I agree with it, but I definitely agree with that. I think that that's might have something to do with it. I think Rossi is a very, very calculating individual, and that these comments might possibly have something along those lines of that. In rebuttal, Carl Fogarty, world superbike champion and famous, English racer and all that sort of good stuff, made the comments that he thinks that James Toesland can go out there and win his first MotoGP race, which I think is overly confident. So somewhere in between will lie the truth. I think that James Toesland will do quite well, actually, there on the Tech 3 Yamaha. I'm looking forward to see them running on the Michelins next year, and just to sort of see how well things work out for them. And with Colin Edwards as a teammate, he's going to do all right. But it remains to be seen exactly how well they'll do, and hopefully they'll be up there, high mid-pack, that sort of a thing. Maybe even, who knows, a podium or two, something like that. Kind of doubt he's going to win any races the first year, to be honest with you. That's my prediction. But he will do relatively well. All right. So there's finally some MotoGP news on MotoGPOD. We're not getting a whole lot of that lately. But a little bit more that we do have that's on the line of MotoGP news is that Len Padilla, longtime listener, has launched a new website called fans.moto.gp. So it's moto.gp. And there's no .com or anything like that. It's just moto.gp. So fans.moto.gp. And this is an unofficial fan site for MotoGP racing with an emphasis on membership. It's got articles, his podcast, which basically he's sort of rerunning my podcast, his photos and all sorts of stuff from expert analysts as well as member contributors and all this sort of thing. It's a site where everyone can contribute. And it's the whole social networking sort of a thing with forums and blog postings and all that kind of stuff of people talking about MotoGP. It's kind of a neat site. It's very, very nice looking. He's definitely done a good job on the appearance with the site. It's good stuff. I encourage you to take a look at that and check it out, and go to the MotoGP fan community at fans.moto.gp. And, of course, we will have a link to that on the website. And then speaking of websites and stuff like that, a listener, Bob Hines, sent me an email about MotoGP viewing on Speed TV, which here in the United States, we get our MotoGP on Speed, which is the cable channel that shows more NASCAR than anywhere else. And he says, Bob says, maybe a great showing for MotoGP on this poll, which is, it's a poll on speedtv.com. Maybe a great showing for MotoGP on this poll would help get motorcycle racing a little bit more attention on Speed. Like maybe getting to see the championship deciding world superbike race on the same damn day. I'd like to see that too, Bob, believe me. He says, scroll down to the bottom of the page at the poll on the speedtv.com website. It's on their news page. Again, I will put a link up to it on the MotoGPOD website. But there's a little poll down there, and it basically the question of the poll is, what sporting event are you looking forward to the most? And there's Formula One, Le Mans, NASCAR, MotoGP, a few things like this. When Bob sent me the email, he said that there's 19% in response. And when I went and posted my thing that I'm looking forward to MotoGP the most, it was up to 34%. It was leading the pack. So not 100% sure where it's right now, but go ahead and take a look there. speedtv.com/news. Down there at the bottom, go ahead and vote in that poll. All right, moving on. Some of the stuff that we've gotten, like I said, this whole track day bike race, you know, I want to be an amateur racer bike, whatever it is, a sort of a motorcycle that you buy that is dedicated for use on a racetrack, not even necessarily street legal. This has generated so much email and listener response and all sorts of stuff that I'm going to kind of keep running with it because it's a little bit slow in the MotoGP news news area right now. So this is interesting stuff. It's interesting to me. It's interesting to you. I think we all sort of like it. And I had a couple of emails from the Australian contingent this past week or two. First of all, Paul down there in Australia. And unfortunately, I don't have his last name here, which I should know because I've exchanged quite a few emails with Paul. But it's not on this email, and I can't find any that have his last name. So, Paul, sorry about that. Down there in Australia, says he has something to add to the track day bike story. As if that dead horse can take any more flogging, and oh yes, it can, Paul, and it's gonna. But he says, up until recently, I had a KTM 640 super moto bike that I used for commuting and track days. And it was great fun, and I really missed it when I traded in for a KTM Super Duke, which is an awesome road bike, and yeah, indeed, Paul, and really cool looking. So a couple of weeks ago, I bought a 2004 Husqvarna SM450R super motorbike, which is registrable, but he intends to use it exclusively as a track bike. And his point is, Paul says, super motorbikes are a great alternative to a traditional sports bike. They're a bit slower, yes, indeed, but the speeds are comparable to a 400cc sports bike, which we're going to get to in a minute. But it helps your skills as you have to carry a lot of corner speed, and this is the whole thing. And you put on a set of sticky tires like the Bridgestone's BT-002s. He says you can get some awesome lean angles. Obviously, you're going to get killed on the straights as far as outright speed, but the next corner you can brake so much later than the sporty bike guys, and you nip up the inside, assuming you're not at Phillip Island. And he says, one big plus about supermoto bikes is that they're incredibly crash tolerant. I lost the front on mine at about 60 miles an hour on the track, and we had a bit of a slide. I picked it up, and apart from the dirt, the damage was only a slightly ground away front brake lever ball end. Hand guards, axle sliders, exhaust sliders, and foot peg sliders kept all of the expensive metal bits off of the road, and there were no fairings to worry about. I picked the bike up, and I kept on riding with no damage to him either. He says, I've seen a lot of super motorbikes crash, and it's very, very hard to kill them. I was following a mate on a track day, and he high-sided in front of me. The bike left the ground and almost did a 540-degree flip before landing hard on the track. No damage at all to the bike, but he had a bit of a sore head. It's great fun turning up at a track day on what is essentially a dirt bike and watching people's faces, which is mostly a look of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I once pitted next to a beautiful Honda SP2 and started chatting to the guy that rode it, and I asked if I'd like to join his group on a road ride. He noticed my KTM 640, and he said, do you have a road bike? I told him I had another bike, but I mostly use the KTM on the road. He says, well, get your road bike out and come for a ride with us. And then when we went out on track, I rode around him on the fastest corner of the track on the outside. When he got back to the pits, he said, wow, you were fast out there. But your bike can lean over a lot more than mine. And so, you know, good point that Paul's making here. There are other options besides your traditional, you know, 600cc or liter bike or whatever sport bike to to, you know, if you want to consider for a track day bike, and Supermoto is definitely one way to go. And another big advantage to it is it opens up a lot more tracks, a lot, at least in the United States. There's a lot more opportunities to ride a Supermoto because there's so many go-kart tracks and a variety of other Supermoto sort of venues that can be available. So you may not have to drive as far or wait as long for a date or whatever. Now, while we're talking about the track day bike alternatives, got another email from another listener in Australia, and this is Zoran Perowski. And he says, I myself own three track bikes, and I thought that I should expand upon some of the options that I feel you have overlooked, namely the 400cc class. He says he owns two 400cc track bikes and thinks that it's the most affordable, reliable, and fun class for anybody looking to get their hands on a track bike. Yeah, the 400cc Japanese motorcycles that exist were developed in the late 80s to the mid-90s for two reasons. One, pollution and licensing laws in Japan, and two, for the National 400cc Racing Series in Japan. They're extremely well-built, reliable, and they can be ridden by all level of riders. There's slightly worked engines and stuff like that. They can reach speeds over 230 kilometers an hour, which is quite fast, at 130 miles an hour, right? A 400cc class is the national entry level of racing and track days in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, and they compete directly with 250cc two-stroke machines in the Isle of Man TT. They make you learn to carry corner speed, and you ride proper lines to maintain a good lap time. And if history tells us anything, the best riders in the world are those that have had to learn to ride this way. Options available prospective owners are Honda VFR 400R, Honda RVF 400R, the Honda CBR 400RR, and Kawasaki ZXR 400. He's not sure if Suzuki built a sports bike 400cc machine to compete in the Japanese series or not. But in any case, these 400cc machines have true racing pedigree, and they're all four-stroke engines. And on top of this, the bikes, even if they are not road registrable, they maintain their value 15-plus years after production. They're considered so well-engineered that they are touted as being bulletproof. So when you're buying one, you're guaranteed, almost guaranteed, to get your money back on resale even years after purchase. Now, I've done some investigating here in the States. I don't think most of these bikes were ever sold new. If I'm wrong on that, you know, send me an email and all that. But it seemed like all the used 400cc bikes I could find were imported gray market for one reason or another. They do tend to hold quite a premium on value and everything. My concern would be obtaining parts and all that sort of stuff on a motorcycle that was gray market like that. It is out there. You know, you do a search on eBay for 400cc motorcycles and you get quite a few things coming up. So I'm sure it comes up and then they're out there. And those would make a worthy track bike because, you know, Jim Race, you know, longtime listener and participant in the MotoGPOD podcast, rides a Ninja 250 out there on track days. It doesn't have to be a big, giant bike to have a good time on a track day. We know that, and it's just something that is, you know, sort of another alternative out there to the traditional sort of things. As far as my track bike search has how it's been going, I found a few alternatives and sort of things. I'm still keeping my eyes open for that one deal that I just cannot pass up, and I'm also going to readjusting my budget a little bit, definitely bumping it up. I'm going to wait till I get my tax return back, sort of see how much I can swing, you know, maybe we'll get some donations for the podcast in, that sort of thing, and step up to the plate a little bit and get maybe a slightly more recent, either a 600cc or an SV650. I really kind of actually have really seriously been looking at the SV650, and I'd kind of like to get one that's track prepped already. But needless to say, I'm still looking around, and we'll find something. I will keep you posted on how that's all going. Okay, next little topic that we got going on our mini intro here, which is turning into a kind of a maxi intro. I had two emails come in on the same day. And this was pretty much right after the last show that I did. And I thought they were both a little bit connected. So the first one is from listener Julie Hill. And she says, hey, I just listened to your latest podcast. It got me thinking about the riders. MotoGP and Superbikes, etc. They seem to be not only in a male-dominated sport, but they're exclusively male. Do you see any changes coming to that soon? I've noticed in the area where I ride, there seem to be more and more women riders than in years past, and I wondered if that change might carry over into the sport as well. Just idle curiosity. Thanks for your work on the podcast, blah, blah, blah. And that is definitely true. We have a number of up-and-coming young women racers that I think you're going to see in the upper ranks. And this is a sport where women can compete. And we're going to get to that here in half of a second with some of the comments. Jeez, can't seem to talk today. Might be too much beer. Some of the comments that I made back to an email in reply to Mally Dangerous, who sent me this. She says, "You mentioned in the podcast that MotoGP needs to bring in more sponsorship money. I often wonder what will happen once MotoGP gets a competitive female like Danica Patrick. Of course, there's no telling when it will happen, but it would be interesting fanfare. What do you think?" I think it's definitely true. I think that Katja Penskin, when she was racing in the 250cc class a few years ago, definitely got more press than would normally be merited by her performance. And she wasn't doing all that well, but, you know, she wasn't doing all that badly either. She was, you know, somewhere in between. But if you got a talented young woman up there in the 250cc race class, sort of a thing, mid-level pack kind of thing, they would, she'd get a lot of attention. And it would be a lot like Danica Patrick, where and this is not knocking Danica Patrick's performance in the IRL or whatever series she's racing in now, but the level of attention, just simply because she's a woman, is considerably notched up quite a bit. And I think that would make it easier for the racer to get sponsorship, and it would also tend to bring sponsorship to the series as a whole, just because you have more attention. And that's what drives sponsorship, is attention to the series, attention to the racer. So I think it'd be a good thing. I think that MotoGP, motorcycle racing in general, is a sport. You know, it's not something like American football, where a woman is just going to get killed. And upper body strength is, yes, extremely important. But a lot of these women are very, very strong, and they're very capable riders, and they can go out there, and they're lighter, so they have that advantage as well. And and we've seen what Danny Pedrosa can do with a tiny little guy that doesn't have a lot of upper body strength, and he still manages to go out there. Yes, he looks like he's about half dead at the end of a race, but he manages to finish and all of that because the guy's training and doing what he can to maintain what upper body strength he has. And I think that when you get a woman up there doing the same sort of thing, she's going to do really well, and she's going to bring more attention than her typical position in the rankings would necessarily warrant. And that's, sort of a plus, a big plus for them. So the comments on that. And then last thing we had, I mentioned the Barry Sheen documentary that was possibly going to be on TV because it was showing up on the Biography Channel in the UK. I mentioned that a couple weeks ago. And it's doesn't seem to be showing up in the United States, that's for sure. Mark Callan, longtime listener, sends in an email. He says it's only going to appear on the Biography Channel in the UK, so you can watch the trailer for that Barry Sheen documentary if you want. And he's got a link, which I'll just go ahead and put on the website. It's a tinyurl.com link, and so it's kind of confusing and messy. But go to MotoGPOD, and there will be a link there in the show notes to see the Barry Sheen biography trailer. And right after that last episode, I got an email from listener James Taylor telling me about a documentary on the Discovery Channel called Birth of a Racer. And this is a documentary about the Motocis C1. And he sent me a link that actually this is for Road Racing World, and I sure hope I don't get sued. But since they're just reprinting a press release, I think it might be all right. But Road Racing World says that, from a press release issued by MotoCis, which I could have just gone to the MotoCis website and got this press release myself, and then I would have avoided that whole Road Racing World issue, huh? In any case, last 2 years, Michael Sis and the MotoCis team have been followed and filmed by a production crew from the Discovery Channel. The two-hour documentary called Birth of a Racer is the first high-definition documentary to be released by Discovery, blah, blah, blah. The film shows the accomplishments and failures experienced by the MotoCis team while trying to bring an American-designed and built machine back to the forefront of international road racing. The documentary will begin airing this week, and this is an old press release. Unfortunately, all these dates that I have are from quite a while ago. And here's the interesting thing. They're all from Discovery's international channels. Not the United States is still listed as to be determined. This show has not yet been scheduled to air on Discovery Channel. We're talking about a motorcycle that's designed right up the street from me in Portland, Oregon, the United States, and we're doing a big documentary on Discovery Channel, which is, you know, a large cable channel here in the United States that does things of interest, and they have covered motorcycles quite a bit. They haven't bothered to show this show. However, it's been on Discovery Benelux, Discovery Asia, Discovery Japan, Discovery Latin, Discovery India and Taiwan, Discovery Poland, Discovery France, Discovery Russia, Discovery Central Europe, Discovery Romania, Discovery Italy, Discovery Spain and Portugal, Discovery Australia and New Zealand, and Discovery Denmark and Poland. So what I think you ought to do is send an email, or better yet, write a real live letter to Discovery Channel and tell them they need to pull their heads out. Maybe just not run that rerun of Mythbusters or Shark Week or whatever it is, some of the other stuff that they tend to show ad infinitum. And don't get me wrong, I do like Discovery Channel. I think it's good stuff. I think it's mildly educational for the most part. And, you know, it's much better than some of the fare that we get on TV. But I think they might want to pay attention to the American market, that there are people here that like motorcycles and will watch it. And even though Discovery Channel forced American Chopper down our throats a few years ago, maybe we'd like to see something about a real American-designed motorcycle, a real motorcycle that's actually truly rideable and could conceivably be, you know, one of the next big things. There we go. What's that, like 2 or 3 rants in just a few minutes? So why don't we move on and do our call with Doug Hagee? All right. We got Doug Hagee from Shadow Video Productions on the phone with us today. Doug runs Shadow Video Productions, and they're a track day videographer organization out there on the East Coast and the Midwest. You may have seen them if you do some track days out there. And basically, in a nutshell, you shoot video of people as they're doing a track day, right, Doug?
That's right, Bob. We actually are associated with a few different track day clubs in the East Coast and the Midwest. And what we do, much like a photographer, we show up at these events that we're associated with, and we provide video services for the riders at these events. So, we've been doing it since 2005. We're looking forward to rolling into our fourth year here. In 2008, we got a lot of new cool things to talk about this year.
Cool. Now, other than the obvious benefit of just seeing, you know, how cool you look out there on the track, what do you think are some benefits that a track day rider can get out of doing this?
Well, I think most people who ride motorcycles will agree that it's not something that is that easy to do. There are many, many inputs that are needed to ride a motorcycle, not only safely, but quickly around a racetrack, and most people are trying to get themselves faster and faster while staying safe at the same time. So what the video does is it allows people to look at that after they're done riding, because it's very hard to perceive everything that you're doing while you're on the track riding the motorcycle. I don't know how many inputs there are. I think someone did try to calculate that once. I think there's over 100 different little things you do while you're on the motorcycle that most of it you do unconsciously. We can make improvements with by viewing those things after someone gets off or finished their track session. And the person can make little tweaks here and there to make their next session that much more safe and possibly that much more quick.
So on a typical session when you're out there in a track day and your customer kind of comes up, how many laps do you follow around and kind of get in, or how much time? How does that work?
Sure. When a customer comes to our booth to sign up for a video, they have the whole session to themselves. We dedicate the whole track session, whether it be 15 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever the track club is using for that day, and we dedicate the whole session for their video. So from the minute they roll one wheel onto the track to the time they come off when the checkered flag is thrown, we are on them as best we can. So that's usually about, you know, 10 to 15 laps, 15 to 20 minutes, like I mentioned before, and we're trying to stay behind them and get as much video footage of them as possible.
Cool. Have you had, this is kind of an interesting question, but are you yourself riding the motorcycle rider? Do you have a colleague or a coworker or something that does that for you?
Yeah, actually, well, I've been riding on the track for many years now, and this whole thing started with buying a video mount or a video camcorder mount myself and putting it on my track bike and making some videos for myself and my friends. And then it kind of turned into a business like we're talking about right now. So I do ride myself. I do some videoing when possible. However, we've gotten to the point where I actually have about 20 riders between myself, my crew here on the East Coast, and my two other crews based in Wisconsin and Michigan. And usually the event captain, the person who's running the deal, stays behind the booth, helps people get signed up for it, does the payments, sets the camera up, organizes the videos, because it's very important. Actually, I think one of the easiest parts of this whole process is actually going out and riding. Organizing the video and making sure all the technical ends are being held up under the booth are very important. So I do ride when I can. I try to ride as much as possible. However, if we're having a good, busy day, I'm usually underneath the canopy signing people up and organizing videos.
Okay. What I was kind of curious about is that the level of skill that you would have in order to, you know, you're following somebody who may or may not be all that good of a rider, may not be very experienced on the track and all of that, might be somewhat unpredictable. And you've got to maintain, I'm assuming, a fairly close distance, right, and kind of judge where he's going to take maybe not the best line or that sort of thing. Otherwise, you're going to have problems with going out of frame. Is that something that you've kind of run into where it's sort of difficult for videographer riders to adapt to the customer?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I'll first start off by saying that one of the biggest challenges of doing this, Bob, is to recruiting riders that work for me that are quick, skilled, and can act responsible, meaning that, first off, all the guys that I recruit to ride for me are advanced-level track day riders. I have a good handful of expert-level Weir and CCS riders, too. So just because you've ridden your bike on the track and you have a fast bike doesn't mean that you'll be able to do a good video job while you're on the track. We know that we're going to have some customers that are not going to take the perfect lines and maybe ride a little erratic. We do the best we can to stay behind them, roughly, you know, 5 to 10 bike lengths, which is the optimal focal point for the cameras, and follow them the best we can. So sometimes we have novice riders or intermediate riders that are not doing things that are real consistent and really need to be improved upon. And sometimes we're trying to get by some of those riders while we're trying to video some of our customers. So it does make it a challenge for our riders. Videoing in the advanced group, as long as the customer isn't too fast, is actually easier because it's very predictable out there on the track with more of the advanced guys. With the novice and intermediate, sometimes they do things that aren't really predictable. They'll check up on the brakes. They'll make a turn entry point way too soon or maybe even too late and do some crazy things that we're not used to in the advanced group. So it's a challenge that way. I'm very confident in my riders. We've done many, many hundreds of videos, and we've had some issues, and sometimes we actually have to pull off the track and stop the video session because what we're seeing is just not consistent with safety and club rules. So I need riders that are responsible enough to make that decision and not cause any more problems out there. So it's a challenge. I'm very confident in all the guys that ride for me, and we've had success so far. In our three seasons, we've only had three crashes from my riders, and that's, you know, almost 1,000 videos. So and those were silly crashes from maybe wet conditions or new tires, but we actually have a very, very safe track record for all the videos and all the track riding we do during the season.
That's cool. And back to the usability of the video as far as a learning tool and all of that sort of thing. When you say a guy comes out and he's riding sort of he's a good rider, but he's riding a different bike. Have you found that this is something that can help him? Because maybe he's got to adapt the different bike to the track or are you following what I'm saying? This is a little bit of a clumsy question.
Sure, I understand. I mean, I think when you're trying to get used to a new track, a new bike, you might even have new leathers on that you're trying to break in because they're very stiff. You know, when you come back after doing a video session and we put the video through our big screen, the monitors that we have at each of our events, we can see these things. You know, maybe someone isn't getting off the bike enough because it is a new bike and they're afraid to lean it over. Maybe next session they'll lean it over a little more because they'll have more confidence by seeing what they were doing beforehand. Maybe their leathers are a little stiff and they can't get their tush off the back of the bike because their knees aren't bending well because the leathers are too stiff, those types of things. Any type of feedback the person can get, of course, you know, as an advanced level rider, you know, we just think about turn entry points, exit points, you know, rolling off the throttle, some of the advanced things. And sometimes we have to understand that some of the beginner and intermediate guys are not thinking that way and might look at some other basic things such as just position on the bike, how their leathers are feeling, you know, how the bike is working, that type of thing. So any type of feedback that the person get to help them improve their skills is definitely definitely a part of the process here. And we've been surprised over the last couple of years we've been doing this, so what type of feedback the people take into consideration after they get off the bike. Sometimes it surprises us, and sometimes people just like to look at their shiny tailpipe as opposed to anything else. So whatever the reason, you know, we help them enjoy their day that much more, of course.
Cool. And now, you did a video with Travis Pastrana last year in Pennsylvania, correct?
Yeah, that was an interesting story. Travis actually lives in Maryland, and I guess for those of you out there in the sport bike world that don't know, and who I guess not many would, and Travis Pastrana is a very experienced, fearless freestyle motocross rider. And he actually brought a super motard motorcycle to a track we have here in Pennsylvania in the Poconos. And he didn't have a part for his bike, so he was not able to use his bike that day. So we invited him over to the video booth, and we offered one of our bikes for him to ride. And we actually went out and videoed Travis. And it was very interesting to come back and watch the video, being that Travis is a very experienced dirt bike rider, and how he moved the he was on a Suzuki GSXR, how he moved the sport bike around the track, compared to guys who are used to riding sport bikes as opposed to motocross tracks, motocross bikes, I should say. Travis, of course, he's very fast on no matter what he's on, was riding it like a dirt bike. And even though he was getting the bike around the track, he looked at it and we were realizing that you know, he could make a million improvements on a million, I should say, a handful of improvements and probably get himself around at a very expert level pace by the end of the day. But it was a good learning experience. It was very interesting to see a professional dirt bike rider on a sport bike, and we learned a lot from it. I'm sure Travis did also.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I know Travis, yeah, is a huge kind of into everything with dirt bikes and rally cars even, and now he's doing all of his wide variety of sort of, I don't know, extreme sports or whatever, but I've never really heard much about him being a street bike rider. So what kind of level of experience did he have at all on something like a GSXR, do you know?
Well, I had one of my fast guys following him around, and Pocono Raceway is a very technical course. The straightaway is roughly a fourth gear, fifth gear for real fast guy straight. So it's very very technical. So he was having my rider, the guy who was doing the video work, was using a lot of his skill to get around to follow Travis. He was quick. He was, I got to give him a lot of credit. He was on a bike that was very unusual to him, something he's not used to. And he got out there and he moved around at an advanced level pace. It was, and doing it at a very kind of non-traditional style on a sport bike, if you will. But nonetheless, he was getting around quickly. I mean, the guy has gobs and gobs of talent, and I'm sure he's fast on anything. But, you know, given a couple days and watching some video, and I'm sure Travis could get himself around and drag some knee pretty quickly. But it was fun to watch him.
Yeah, interesting. Certainly no slouch then in anything is Travis. So when you at the end of the session, and the customer can see the video there on the screen in your booth, and then they get what, like a DVD? You make the DVDs right there at the track?
Well, what we've been doing for the last 3 years, Bob, is actually providing a produced DVD for the customer. What we do is we want to make this DVD more than just something they can look at to review their skills, Bob. But we really want to make it a keepsake, something they can watch years later and really enjoy themselves, like a video scrapbook, if you will. So we really take our time. We put an introduction in the front of the video. We put the name of the customer, what the bike they're riding, the day they're riding, the track that they're riding, and try to make it look as polished as possible. And then we mail these out to the customers. However, this year we're going to be doing something a lot different. We're moving to a new technology with our camera systems. It's going to allow us to deliver the video to the customer at the track. So we're very excited. We're testing these things out right now, as a matter of fact. And I think we're going to have a real good setup next year to not only do videos more reliably, but also deliver the video at the track so the customer, if they choose, does not have to wait for it to be mailed out to them the week later.
Cool. What is that technology, if you don't mind us touching on that?
We've been using Mini DV, Bob, as our standard. It's reliable. The quality's high. Mini DV format for our video cameras. We're going to actually move to a solid-state system that's going to record on compact flash cards. And the nice thing about that is that the video system actually creates a file that can be manipulated in a computer without having to download frame by frame the mini DV tapes, if anyone out there is familiar with how that works. So it's a much more efficient process. The nice thing about these new systems is that they're not prone to having problems with vibration. One of the challenges we have with the mini DV cameras is if someone wants to rent one of our cameras, which we offer to, we will put a camera on a customer's motorcycle as well as follow them around with our cameras. If people are coming to the booth and they have a big V-twin engine, the Ducatis, and of course the Aprilias and some of the Hondas, sometimes we have some vibration issues using the mini DV tape format, and it's been a challenge. So with these new systems, we're not going to have to use those mini DV systems anymore. Solid state, they're not prone to having problems with the vibration. They're reliable, and the quality is just as good with the system we're moving to, if not maybe a little better in some aspects than the cameras we're using previously. So we're really excited about that.
That's super interesting. And these are issues I hadn't really thought of, because I'm familiar with the whole track day video thing, and I've actually had it done myself. And you just sort of assume that this is a standard video camera mounted on a bike. You know, how hard can it be? But like the vibration issue you bring up, that's kind of an interesting point. So does that sort of the bikes that you use as your video bikes, do you have to kind of avoid, you know, like the big twins and things like that, or how did, you know, are your videographers riding their own motorcycles, or are they riding a motorcycle that's owned by Shadow Video, and does the bike type sort of determine you know, if it can be used or not?
That's a good question, Bob. And the answer to that is yes, yes, and yes. I do have a handful of motorcycles that my riders can use if they choose, and they are all inline fours, so the vibration issue wasn't such a big deal. However, my guys in the Midwest, they use their own motorcycles. My guys in Michigan, especially, they're Ducati and Aprilia guys. So we had some issues with their motorcycles, especially the Aprilia last year, because the vibration through the gas tank, which is where these cameras are mounted, was just overbearing for these mini DV cameras, and it was causing the tape to jump off the recording head, and just a whole bunch of other issues, and it wasn't reliable. So now with these new systems, no moving parts, everything is solid, just electricity going through some circuitry in these little boxes. It records on a solid state memory card, SD. We're going to be using compact flash. So yeah, our riders do use their own bikes if they want. They always have that choice. The camera systems we use can be put on anyone's motorcycle in under 2 minutes. And it's very simple. It's removing a couple bolts and putting a couple extra bolts on top of it. So we have a very efficient system that's been reliable. I mean, we're not perfect, and I'm sure you can understand, Bob, that when you're doing high-speed video, even when you watch a MotoGP race or a World Superbike race, or even more so a AMA race, that when you see the onboard video, a lot of times it can be choppy, and they have their issues too, and they're using million-dollar systems. So our systems aren't quite $1 million, but they're very reliable. We, like I said, do hundreds of videos every season, and we don't have that many problems. We do sometimes, of course. Anything that has to deal with electronics, you're going to run into some problems here and there. But we have a pretty reliable system. I think these new systems that we're going to be moving to are going to be even more reliable.
Cool. Now, for people that want to do their own video work, maybe, you know, even out on a street ride or whatever, we've all seen these sort of systems where you can mount a camera on a motorcycle and stuff. And I know a lot of people who do that, and they have a variety of different, you know, cool little gizmos. Some of them will even put the some of the telemetry into the video frame, you know, the speed and all that. Do you have any kind of advice for people beyond the thinking about a compact flash, which is an excellent idea? Any other sort of advice that they might want to consider of types of mounts to use or things to avoid, like some of these, you know, really small lipstick type cams, the consumer level, you know, maybe for a couple $100 or anything? Would you say that any of those are good ideas or bad ideas or something for the average rider that wants to do stuff like this?
Well, I will say this, that I always get asked the question between, you know, a tank-mounted camera, which is a camera that would mount onto a bracket attached to your gas tank, or a helmet camera. There's pluses and minuses to both. The helmet cameras, for our purposes, are very difficult to set up because when you place the bullet lens or the camera, the recording device, on the helmet, you have to get a good position so that it captures good video when the person's either in a tuck behind their motorcycle windscreen or when they're sitting up on the motorcycle. So sometimes if you don't get the camera in the right position, you can either be seeing the sky or seeing the ground, and it doesn't make for good video. So helmet camera systems are good if you have time to set it up and you're patient with that. I suggest using the tank mount systems with a mini DV camera. That's right now the cheapest and best quality way to go. My systems, I've used the bullet lenses. I plan on using the bullet lenses in the future. They're actually making bullet lenses that have you know, broadcast NTSC quality video and 520 lines of resolutions and higher. So you're getting really, really good DVD quality digital video out of these systems. So it depends on how much you want to spend. You know, the solid state systems that we're going to be moving to this season for a full setup, bullet lens and recording device and the compact flash card, you're looking at about $1,000. But these systems are reliable and they do a good deal. And for a company such as Shadow Video, we need reliability. We need to be able to handle high volume. So those systems are for us. If you're just an average track day guy and you're looking to get some video of yourself, quality isn't that much of an issue for you. You don't have to have it a DVD quality. There are other units out there that are under $300 that give you a good quality, can give you some good video to enjoy and have fun with without breaking your bank. So, and one more thing I want to add to that, Bob, because you mentioned about the technology, maybe lap timers integrating things into the video. These new systems we're moving to next year actually can integrate a lap timer into the video. So each of our shadow riders are going to have a lap timer on their motorcycles. We're going to have a beacon at each track event we go to on the sidelines to help trigger these track lap timers, and we're going to integrate a lap time into the video so that the customer has even more feedback or something else to help them review the track sessions. Along with watching themselves, they can see how fast they were going lap to lap and see what differences in style or technique or what they were doing to create the difference in track times and lap times. So we're real excited about that also.
Yeah, that's a neat development. One other thing you mentioned is that you are a practicing physical therapist and that you've used video analysis in the past to work with your patients. How did you do that? How does that work?
Well, I've been doing physical therapy for 15 and a half years. And sometimes when you're helping people learn to move again, providing them with visual feedback is very important. Sometimes people just can't perceive what they're doing without either watching themselves in a mirror, which of course isn't real practical on a racetrack, or watching pictures of themselves do this. There's still pictures through a camera. So I have integrated video into therapy in the past. I have patients watch what they do. If it's something as simple as learning to walk again to something as complex as learning how to throw a baseball or improving the way a pitcher throws a baseball with his biomechanics, same thing goes with the video. Someone that can watch what they're doing and learn from that will be able to change and make the problems not as apparent and help increase their skills just from watching what they were doing wrong in a previous session and improve their technique and style and safety, of course, afterwards. So having someone see what they're doing, and like I was mentioning before, video analysis helps someone see things that they might not have been aware of while they were on the track. Now, I'm going to make a comparison here, Bob, that it's kind of a little bit of a stretch in motorcycle world, but video analysis is very commonly used in the game of golf. There are lots of little intricacies that go into hitting a golf ball straight and consistent. Well, the same thing goes for riding a motorcycle, consistent and safe. There are lots of different inputs that are needed, and if you can hone in on these little inputs and dial them in and tune them in real efficiently, then you'll have a safer experience and you'll become faster and more skilled. And that's what we're interested in doing. The fun of watching yourself on a video and going around a racetrack and showing it to your friends and family afterwards, that's part of it. But we're really pushing the skill set and helping people learn how to move their machines around the track safely and having more fun at the same time. So lots of different uses for video, and it has lots of different practical applications, absolutely.
Right, right. A very valuable learning tool, I've found it to be so. And, all right, now this is something, like I said, you guys, Shadow Video Productions, you tend to work on the East Coast and the Midwest. As everybody knows, I'm in Oregon on the West Coast, and we've got tracks all over the country. Every track that I've been to, there's been somebody or other, some kind of company or another, doing this sort of videography, and it is a neat tool, and it's relatively inexpensive. How much do you charge for a session there, Doug, with for yours?
Well, what we charge for our customers, if you want one of our shadowing sessions, which is one of our camera guys either following you, or if you want to be seen from the front, Bob, we offer a foreshadowing session, which is we turn the cameras on the rear, on the backside of our motorcycle, and we have the customer follow us if they choose to be seen from the front. One full session, which is however long the club that we're running with will go, 20 minutes is the standard usually, that is $70. Or $69.99. If a customer would like to rent one of our cameras and put it on his or her motorcycle for the session, that is $59.99, $60 for one whole session. We will mount the camera onto their bike for them and make the video. One of our real popular offerings is what we call our shadow combo. And what we do is we put a camera on our customer's motorcycle, and we also provide them with a video shadowing session. And the benefit of that is they can get so much feedback, Bob, from having a camera on their motorcycle, because just from watching your motorcycle, it doesn't give you the complete picture of what's going on out there. Actually hearing what you're doing with the throttle, hearing when you're rolling on the throttle, hearing when you're rolling off the throttle, which is what the camera on mounted on the customer's bike will give you because of the microphone, is a very valuable tool also. Some people say, oh, I thought I was getting on the throttle a little earlier. Oh, I didn't realize I was cutting it off so quickly. I can get on it earlier. I can get off it later, so on and so forth. Well, our tank cam rentals really kind of help create the full picture so the customer can see exactly what they're doing on the motorcycle. So our shadow combo, which is actually three videos, Bob, one full-screen version of the shadow session, which is our rider behind them, one full-screen session of the tank cam, which is the camera mounted on the customer's motorcycle, and then we give them a special treat. We take both of those videos and format them side by side, and we sync them up so that they're working together, so the person can actually see what they were doing and hear what they're doing on the motorcycle at the same time. So that is $120. But that's a great value because they're getting three videos for less the price of two. So we really push that because that really gives you the overall feel and perspective of your motorcycle riding.
Yeah, that combo deal, I haven't seen that particular sort of offering at any of the track days I've done. So that is neat. That's a cool thing. But in any case, for under $100, you can get this video. And like you say, even if it's just nothing more than a sort of a keepsake because you're not going to do a whole lot of track days and you just want to, impress your friends, or if you use it like it really should be used as a learning tool and all of that sort of thing so that you can make your pointers, it's a worthy investment. You've already spent a fair amount of money to go to the track day. A few more bucks is actually making this track day that much more of a valuable experience for you, and it's something that you really should look into. We've been talking a lot about track days here on MotoGPOD lately, and these are just all of the variety of cool things that are offered there at the track, along with like the suspension setup guys and the photographers and the tire help and all the other things, the help from just the your fellow track day riders. These are all bits and pieces of the puzzle to make you a better rider, to make you enjoy yourself more out there, whether you're trying to focus on improving your street skills or trying to be a better track day rider only, or a better racer, or whatever you're doing. All of these things are valuable tools. So it's been really cool having you on the show, Doug. And what's your website? And maybe people can go check out your URL and see what tracks you're going to be at, and maybe they can say hello.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob, and thank you for having me on MotoGPOD. I've been a fan for a while now. I've been listening to your broadcast since last May when a friend turned me on to them. So I really enjoy them. I like to get the inside scoop. So I thank you tremendously for having me on. I appreciate being a part of MotoGPOD. And my website is www.shadowvideoproductions.com. And people can log on there and check out our schedule, where we're going to be. We cover events, like you were saying, through the Midwest. So we cover tracks. We cover Road America in Wisconsin, Putnam Park, Black Hawk Farms, Audubon. We cover Groton Raceway, Gingerman Raceway, Mid-Ohio. We're at Virginia International. We do Pocono Raceway here in Pennsylvania. We do Beaver Run right outside of Pittsburgh, and we do Summit Point, West Virginia. We're looking to expand our venues this season. So check us out at shadowvideoproductions.com, and feel free to give me some feedback through the website. And I really appreciate you allowing me to come on here, Bob, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, not at all, Doug. It was a pleasure having you. And I do have one more quick question now. After you railed off that fairly impressive list of tracks, have you yourself been able to ride all of those tracks?
Yes, and actually I left one off there because we don't ride there. We ride there once a season. That's Barber down in Alabama. It's not one of our regular tracks, but I have had an opportunity to ride, with the exception of Daytona, all the East Coast AMA tracks, which has been a real treat and one of the perks from doing this business. And I got to ride Road America for the first time last season, and that is my new favorite track. If anyone is interested in really putting their leader bike to work, there is no better place, maybe aside from Miller Motorsports Park in Utah, the new one they put out last year, than Road America. There are three straights. If you can get it in sixth gear, you should be able to. It's got everything. It is a complete motorcycle sport bike track, Bob. So that's my favorite. Mid-Ohio is a great venue. Barber is a fantastic venue. It's one of my favorites also. Virginia International is a great track, all very smooth, very enjoyable tracks. So, yes, I've been very fortunate enough to ride some of these fun tracks. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Now, Road America was just resurfaced recently, wasn't it?
Road America, I don't know if they've done some work on that. I don't know. When I was there last season, everything was very smooth. I mean, the track is maintained beautifully. So I don't know if it was went through a full repave or not, but it doesn't need it now. I'll put it to you that way, at least the last time I rode it, because it's very smooth and it's just a really great flowing track. And when I was down at Barber, they had just repaved the track also, and that track is just very grippy. It's 50 feet wide everywhere. It's very technical, ups and downs. It's beautiful. Mid-Ohio, they actually repaved 2 years ago, and that track is just, it's a lot of fun. They had a lot of concrete patches on it throughout it previous to the repave, and you take those concrete patches away, and boy, it makes for such a much more enjoyable experience on a sport bike. So it's a fantastic venue, very professional.
Right. Yep. All you guys there on the East Coast are lucky. You've got a lot of tracks to choose from that are relatively short driving distance away. I mean, we have a fair amount out here too on the West Coast. Well, all right. I kind of digressed and extended that goodbye, but thank you very much, Doug. It was a pleasure having you on the show, and hopefully we'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Bob.
All right. In this section here, we're going to do a blast from the past. This is a rerun from episode number 38. This is one of my early tech segments that I did. This particular one is on suspensions, mostly the history of different types of suspensions, some of the older suspensions that you would find on motorcycles of the back in the day, girder forks and all that sort of good stuff. As I was listening to it, it's almost a little painful how the delivery and style of the podcast has changed quite a bit, because it's a little different. So bear with me as we go back in time 2 years, almost exactly 2 years, to episode number 38 from January 13th, 2006. It's an edited version of tech segment number 3 about suspensions. All right. When I recorded that little intro to the suspension segment, I totally forgot to mention what inspired me to rerun the tech segment. And what it was an article in the January 2008 issue of Motorcyclist, which has been out already for a couple of weeks now. In fact, I just got my February issue today in the mail. But you should be able to find the January 2008 issue on newsstands if you don't get Motorcyclist magazine. And it's got a big picture on the front. It's the bikes of tomorrow, and the GSXR Rad is on the front. First test of Suzuki's insane B-King and world exclusive Future Shock, blah, blah, blah. But what is also in there is a really cool article by Alan Cathcart, a fantastic moto journalist, about Radical Racers, Elf's high-tech Grand Prix bikes. And if you haven't heard of the Elf Racers, we briefly mentioned them in the tech segment, and they covered a lot of them here, and Alan Cathcart managed to actually ride most of these motorcycles. So it's not to mention racing the Saxtrax Triumph. So it's an interesting article, and like I said, that inspired me to rerun this little tech segment. First of all, unsprung weight. In a nutshell, unsprung weight is the mass of your motorcycle's tires, wheels, brakes, and suspension, along with anything that's kind of connected to them. Think of it like this. Most of your motorcycle is supported by the suspension, right? There's a fork or a spring in between, say, the engine and the ground. Well, unsprung weight is the stuff that doesn't get supported by the suspension. So these parts are directly affected by bumps and holes in the road and so forth. So the unsprung weight governs the force of the reaction that you get when these parts hit those bumps and holes because of the inertia associated with that unsprung weight. Basically, you want the suspension to absorb the roughness of the road, right? And it's going to do that by allowing the wheels to move up and down when you hit a bump, while the rest of the motorcycle remains, you know, hopefully more or less stable. Well, if the unsprung weight is too high, it means that wheel is going to resist moving upwards when you go over that bump, and it will be harder to stop that upward motion once it finally gets going. And, of course, the same goes for down as well. So it's just like pushing a loaded wheelbarrow or something. You know, the heavier it is, the harder it is to get moving, and the harder it is to stop it. High unsprung weight has a negative effect on overall handling ability, which is why you want the lightest possible wheels, brakes, and suspension components, and everything else that makes up the unsprung weight, combined with the correct suspension settings so that what you end up with are tires that are firmly in contact with the ground and a smooth but firm ride. And, hopefully that defines unsprung weight without flogging a dead horse about it. Unsprung weight will continually come up in any discussion of motorcycle suspension or automobile suspension for that matter. So I kind of wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page about it. Now let's cover some of these old-fashioned suspension designs that I was talking about. And these are things that you might hear about from a variety of places. So one of the things I found out when I started looking around for more information on all of this is that the front suspension of a motorcycle is an area where, at one time or another, just about every manufacturer seems to have tried something that's totally different from whatever is the norm at the time. And when I wrote this article, I also figured out how hard it is to describe a suspension system using words. So there's a page on MotoGPOD.com with some photos that are going to help clear up any confusion. You can find that. There's a link in the little show notes for this show, and it's MotoGPOD.com/suspensions.php. As far as racing motorcycles are concerned, most of the early Grand Prix racing machines, and, you know, by early I'm talking before World War II, so before the official, you know, FIM Motorcycle World Road Racing Championship Series in 1949, most of these earlier motorcycles used girder forks, often with friction damping instead of any kind of hydraulic damping. And a girder fork is just a solid unit that's attached to the rest of the motorcycle with kind of a parallel link arrangement. So if you've ever seen a set of parallel rulers, like the ones kind of used for navigation on the ship, that's pretty much how it works. One ruler represents the motorcycle steering head, and the other, the top of the forks. And so when I say the girder, you know, is a solid unit, I don't necessarily mean it's one single solid fork leg on each side, because most of those girder forks used lighter weight tubing to make up the entire girder, you know, in sort of a trellis arrangement. But that tubing does not move in relationship to itself, so the girder as a whole is solid. A disadvantage to girder forks is that as the suspension moves, the wheelbase changes, which seriously affects handling. And girder forks are still seen today. For instance, the Confederate Wraith uses a girder fork, and the Britain V1000, which is a motorcycle I'd like to talk about a lot more one day, also used a type of a girder fork. They're also popular with some of the chopper builders, which makes a lot of sense because a telescopic fork is kind of useless after you rake it out like as much as they often do, because the sliders are so bound up that they just don't slide as freely as they should. So that's about the girder forks. Next common type of front suspension in the evolution of the Grand Prix motorcycle is the leading link fork. Now with a leading link fork, a linkage at the wheel hub connects the springs and maybe a damping system, whether it's friction or hydraulic or whatever, to a static fork leg. As the wheel moves up and down, the linkage pivots, but that static leg doesn't move in comparison to the rest of the motorcycle. So this reduces the amount of change in that motorcycle's wheelbase compared to a girder fork, but it can be unstable at higher speeds. Leading link forks come in a variety of different styles, some with the two sections of tubing running roughly parallel for kind of the entire length of the fork, some with one section and just a shock at the bottom, some with a triangulated sort of arrangement where the sections are at larger angles to each other. Most of the racing bikes with leading link suspensions, at least the ones that I've seen pictures of, used a more or less parallel type of arrangement, and that at first glance it looks a lot like a girder fork. This is often called a springer suspension because you can see the springs at the top near the steering head. Another less common kind of leading link suspension that's really super interesting is the Earl's fork. Earl's forks were patented by a guy named, strangely enough, Ernie Earls, and they eliminate the problem of changes in wheelbase. Basically, you have a leading link fork, but the segment that's attached to the steering head comes down behind the front wheel rather than running parallel to, you know, the hub. A pivoting link goes horizontally from the bottom of that to the wheel hub, and then the third leg of this whole triangular arrangement is a set of shock absorbers. And BMW and MV Agusta both used Earl's forks on racing motorcycles in the 50s. The design of an Earl's fork is also particularly suited for a sidecar because it can reduce steering effort dramatically, and BMW dominated sidecar racing in the 50s using the Rennsport motorcycle with the Earl's fork. However, for a solo machine, the added unsprung weight, there's that term again, the unsprung weight penalty kind of seems to cancel out a lot of any benefits. So, just as girder forks were gradually replaced by leading link forks, then leading link forks were replaced by telescopic sliding forks, similar to that
that are used in the vast majority of motorcycles today. BMW was the first manufacturer to make a racing motorcycle with hydraulically damped telescopic forks way back in 1935, and they did quite well with that motorcycle. AJS also had a racing motorcycle with telescopic forks in the 30s, but then World War II came along and kind of put motorcycle racing on hold for a while. But after the war, companies started to experiment again, and the 50s and 60s really saw that telescopic fork take over from the leading link. Now, we're going to talk about telescopic forks next week. I'm not going to go into any great detail about them right now, but I do want to mention a couple of other things before we finish this part one of our suspension tech segment. Because as with almost everything else, telescopic forks involve compromises. And there's a lot of people that think that there are better solutions than telescopic forks. So we've seen some interesting experiments like, say, the Honda-powered Elf Grand Prix Racer from the mid-80s, the Bimota Tesi, and the Yamaha GTS 1000A civilian motorcycles, all that used a situation called hub center steering. Now, hub center steering means that the front wheel is steered from its hub, from the wheel hub, much like a car, rather than a motorcycle, which is, well, different. Not a telescopic fork arrangement. You're not steering it exactly from the hub. The Elf, the Tesi, and the GTS 1000 are just three of many, many different designs that have tried to do this hub center steering, and each goes about it quite differently. One thing they do have in common is a front swing arm, pretty much like the rear swing arm, except that it doesn't have to deal with the drive chain or anything. It's just holding the wheel and kind of acting as a suspension component. On the Bimota, a double-sided swing arm held the front wheel, and a linkage from the handlebars actually steered the wheel within that swing arm. And there's kind of nothing where the fork would be on a standard motorcycle, just empty space between the fairing and the wheel. So it looks kind of weird in the pictures. There's a picture of it on the website. On the Elf and the Yamaha, a single-sided swing arm was used, and steering input traveled down a leg, which, not, you know, kind of for lack of a better term, that was more or less in the same position that the fork would be on a standard motorcycle. On the Elf, that leg also held a shock absorber. Ron Haslam rode that Elf Honda bike to fourth place in the 500cc championship in 1987, which was only the second year that the bike was competing, which, you know, I kind of think that's not too bad. So I'm not sure why Elf pulled the plug on the whole project after the 1988 season, although Ron Haslam did come in like 11th that year. Yamaha didn't really sell a whole lot of GTS 1000s, although the people that bought them seemed to swear by them, but I think also Yamaha positioned the motorcycle incorrectly. They kind of tried to sell it as a very sporty bike, and it probably should have been more of a sport touring market. It's an interesting motorcycle. And then the Bimota was and still is just a very, very expensive, very unusual motorcycle for people that just really need something unique. They recently brought it back here a couple of years ago with a different engine and so forth. And going to be selling, tiny numbers, something like 30 a year or something like that. And at about $50,000, it's actually still a whole lot less money than one of those cool custom choppers from those guys on TV that you see. And it sure as hell going to get a lot more notice on the street. So might be something to think about. You know, if you got an extra 50 grand laying around, you might want to buy Moto Tizzy. In any case, the world just isn't quite ready for hub center steering right now. But it wasn't too many years ago that the world wasn't ready for telescopic forks or rear suspension of any kind. So you really never know what the future might hold. You know, it's got a lot of distinct advantages to it, and we might see them coming around again. All right, this tech segment just barely touched on some of the different kinds of suspensions that you may hear about and that were used and that have shown up through the years. I didn't talk about some of the things that you think would be obvious, like BMW's telelever suspension or the Saxon Triumph 900 with its SaxTrac suspension, and then the Motosys, which is using a different fork arrangement again. And I never even talked about rear suspensions at all, so it's all a little bit incomplete. But all that stuff leaves room for future shows, and maybe we're going to talk about those another day.
Well, okay. I hope you enjoyed that rerun there of a tech segment. Like I said, it was a little rough. I almost would have just re-recorded the entire thing, but I couldn't find my notes, and I didn't really want to like sort of transcribe it or anything like that. So I just figured I'd kind of run with it and see how it came out. One thing I didn't mention in there is that the website has some visual aids for the that tech segment about suspensions. So you can go to MotoGPOD.com and check it out. There's some photos of the different kind of suspension systems and all that sort of stuff. Just check it out and link right there on the front page, motorcycle suspensions. There we go. Another episode completed for the books, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for bearing with me through the entire length of the thing. That some of that noise in that suspension tech segment, I'm glad I got rid of whatever it was that was making that screechy noise, because it was a little irritating, and I apologize for that. But other than that, I think the show was pretty good, and we just came off a two-week hiatus. We're going to have another show next week. We'll do something or other. We've got MotoGP testing starting very shortly, January 22nd, down there in Malaysia, Sepang. So we'll have some MotoGP stuff to talk about. We're going to finish up all of this chatter about track day bikes soon. It's like I said, everybody's interested in it. It's interesting to me. It's interesting to you. So we'll go ahead and keep running with that for a little while. But whatever, that's going to wrap this show up. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks very much for downloading the show. And I will talk to you again next week. If you listened this far, you know that it's time for the disclaimer. And sometimes you might get tired of hearing these disclaimers. I sort of occasionally get sick of recording them or making up new, slightly entertaining versions, because I've kind of already gone through all the obvious ones, and now I'm just sort of trying to rummage around and find something, somehow, some way to say in a different way that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All the other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.